trying to tamp down the sectarian tensions, but they're certainly there.
How exactly are they going about trying to move in and take the city?
Well, they've tried to clear all these agricultural areas and all these other cities and really tighten a siege that has been underway actually for several months. Going back to December, there's been a siege of the city, and humanitarian organizations have raised concerns for many months about starvation inside the city. The refugee agencies say they've registered one single family from the center of Fallujah that's been able to escape.
Well, when you talk about thousands of people in the city apparently not seizing whatever opportunity there might be to leave, do you have any communication or any sense of why they would stay in that ISIS-controlled area?
My sense is the people in the center of the city cannot leave because ISIS will not let them leave. The ones that have been able to get out are in areas that have come under attack recently and have been able to escape as the fighting's going on. But in the center of the city, all the words that we get is that ISIS will not let them leave, and so they're terrified of leaving for being shot at by ISIS.
Meaning that they can't even get out of their homes to risk going across no man's land.
Exactly,
to the other side.
Exactly. And the Iraqi government and the coalition, the Americans, have pressed the people to put up white sheets on their windows to indicate that they're civilians.
Although you can see so many ways that would go wrong.
Exactly.
Tim Arango of the New York Times joining us by Skype. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
This next story takes us beneath your feet. It's a story about land that now holds houses, schools, and malls. Some of that land has been reused. And beneath those new buildings are abandoned oil and gas wells. Some residents are surprised to learn this, and safety concerns make this more than just a matter of curiosity. Here's Stephanie Joyce with Wyoming Public Radio.
Jeff Parsek lives in a neighborhood of cul-de-sacs and suburban ranch homes on the south side of Fort Collins, Colorado. So it came as news to Parsek that state records show there's an abandoned oil and gas well in his driveway.
Bought the house in 2004 and haven't had any concerns about oil wells or anything else.
Confronted with similar news, several homeowners responded with curses and slammed doors. One yelled, "Thanks for ruining my afternoon." But when I asked Parsek if the news worried him...
It really doesn't. If it started to emit something, then I might, but to this point, I'm not concerned.
The trouble is, it might be hard to know if the well were emitting something. When a well stops producing commercial quantities of oil and gas, companies abandon it, usually by filling the well with cement to stop the flow of gas and fluids. The industry considers that the end of the life of a well.
It's not rocket science to plug these wells.
That's Mark Watson, Wyoming's oil and gas supervisor.
It's a hole in the ground that's pretty deep, and you know, you set cement, and cement lasts a long time.
That firm belief that once a well is plugged, it's dead, means there's no systematic monitoring for leaks. We simply don't know what percent of abandoned wells are leaking. But we do know that at least in a handful of cases, it's happened.
This lot was located off Highway 12.
Back in 2007, Rick Kinder was working for a contractor building a house in southern Colorado. They had just finished sealing the house, putting in all the doors and windows, and Rick and a colleague were working in the crawl space, hanging insulation.
And we just heard this big roar and then a big boom, and it threw us against the walls, and it just blew the whole top of the roof off.
Rick and his colleagues didn't know it, but they were building on top of an abandoned gas well that was leaking methane, an odorless and highly explosive gas. No one was killed in the explosion, but the blast sent Rick into cardiac arrest. He ended up having a quadruple bypass.
And I lost probably a third of my heart, the muscle.
Rick had worked in the oil and gas industry for nearly 30 years. If anyone were going to recognize an old well site, it would be him.
There was no signs, no nothing there that would give us an indication that somebody had built there or had done some work.
Across the U.S., from Pennsylvania to Texas to California, there are millions of abandoned wells, their locations unmapped or poorly mapped. Rob Jackson is a researcher at Stanford University. He says keeping track of them is a low priority.
When a state sees a well is plugged, they typically put a check mark by that well in a database or in a file somewhere, and they don't do anything for the most part.
Unless a well starts leaking fluids or a house blows up, the assumption is that everything is fine. Jackson says it's partly an issue of states not having the resources to monitor.
But I also think the states aren't that interested in some cases, in many cases, in the data. I'm not sure that they really want to know.
In the Canadian province of Alberta, it's a different story. Teresa Watson is an engineering consultant and former Alberta energy regulator. Back in the early 2000s, she started pushing for better tracking, monitoring, and regulation of abandoned wells as people started to move into rural areas that were once oil and gas fields.
If you don't measure it, you don't know what kind of risk you have. I mean, ignorance is bliss, I guess, but I think most people will tell you that they'd want to know.
Which is why Watson recommended not only monitoring abandoned wells near homes, but an outright prohibition on building on top of them.
From a public safety perspective, even a slow leak into a building can cause an explosion hazard.
Alberta now has a 15-foot no-build zone around abandoned wells. But similar rules are lacking in most of the U.S. Even as we can see in places like the Front Range of Colorado, new development is encroaching on old oil and gas fields. State oil and gas regulators say the situation is out of their hands. Stuart Ellsworth is the engineering manager for the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission.
We really try to discourage the construction on top of old wells.
But he says any actual prohibition is up to local governments who permit development. In turn, many of those local governments see abandoned wells as the state's problem.
Somebody needs to be held accountable for it.
That's Rick Kinder again, the construction worker who was injured in the well explosion.
To me, the most important thing is it doesn't happen to somebody else. It doesn't need to happen to somebody else.
He says he doesn't care who ends up making rules about building on top of abandoned wells. He just wants somebody to do it. For NPR News, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
That story came to us from Inside Energy, a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues.
Now let's begin this story with a sound you may well hear on this holiday. The sound of an ice cream truck. You know, in all the years that I ran after those trucks as a kid, I never thought much about the person inside. Maybe I should have, because it's a job, which a British man has done for most of his life.
I think I sold the most ice cream in the world.
Shandor Foldy says he's sold more than 1.3 million cones.
Now, it's hard to confirm that that's the most in the world, but we can confirm he's been selling ice cream for 54 years.
Before working in ice cream, Foldy worked as a police officer and in a circus and as an electrician. You know, the usual career path.
I was doing the electric welding, and my doctor said it's no good for you. Because of the fumes and everything. So he said, would you do something else? So I said, oh, well, I took ice cream.
Why not? And today, according to the Daily Mirror, Mr. Foldy turns 86. He plans to keep selling ice cream until age 99. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 8:18 on this Memorial Day. Thanks for tuning in to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be bringing you the latest news next from NPR and WPR. Hear about a new report that shows that college enrollment is down nationally and what that means for Wisconsin. That story in a couple minutes.
WGTD broadcasts from studios located on the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. In Kenosha and Racine, WGTD is heard at 91.1 FM, Elkhorn at 101.7, Lake Geneva 103.3, and around the world at WGTD.org.
Michoacana. Tours will include our production studios in Vilas Hall and our historic home in Radio Hall on the UW-Madison campus. More details at WPR.org/WeLoveOurListeners.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Iraqi forces are pushing toward Fallujah, west of Baghdad, in a major operation to recapture the city from Islamic State. The BBC's Jim Muir says ISIS has controlled Fallujah for more than 2 years.
They divided this into three phases, the first phase lasting some days to start moving it around the edges, then moving further in the second phase to complete the encirclement of the city at close quarters, and then a final push into the city center. I believe we're somewhere in that second phase. Each of these phases is expected to last some days, but the final phase of going actually into the town itself, the heart of the city, some people reckon that could actually take weeks.
In and around Iraq's capital today, a string of bombings has killed more than 20 people. ISIS is claiming at least two of the attacks. Donald Trump is promising to release a list of veterans groups to which he's donated money. NPR's Sarah McCammon says this goes back to a fundraiser hosted earlier this year.
Trump hosted the event to raise money for veterans groups and to counter-program a Fox News debate in Iowa back in January. There have been a lot of questions about how much money was raised and where the money went. Trump says the total is almost $6 million, and he is promising to release those details soon.
Trump is the presumptive GOP presidential nominee. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. A recent report from the National Student Clearinghouse shows college enrollments fell nationally for the third straight year this semester. Wisconsin saw the fifth largest decline. Clearinghouse Research Manager Jason DeWitt says several factors are driving the change. First, people over 24 are having an easier time finding jobs.
These are the students that fueled the boom in enrollments at two-year publics during the recession. At the same time, during the recession, there's a lot of pressure on state budgets, so institutions tend to become more tuition-dependent, which in the long run can drive enrollments down.
DeWitt says Midwestern and Northeastern states are also seeing their populations age, which means the number of high school grads is leveling off or dropping. Ceremonies are planned throughout Wisconsin on this Memorial Day. State Veterans Affairs Secretary John Skokas says Wisconsin still has soldiers and Marines in harm's way while serving our country, and that's one reason to remember the troops who have died. 126 Wisconsinites have been killed in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars since the September 11th terrorist attacks in 2001. Governor Scott Walker plans to speak today during a ceremony in DeForest at Veterans Memorial Park. Walker was also at a gathering yesterday at the Southern Wisconsin Veterans Memorial Cemetery in Union Grove. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. From Lindemood Bell. Lindemood Bell Learning Centers work to help all students reach their potential for learning. Summer programs are available to improve reading, comprehension, and math. Learn more at lindemoodbell.com. And from the Siebel Energy Institute, supporting scientific research to increase the safety, reliability, security, and lower the environmental impact of energy production, delivery, and consumption. More at siebelenergyinstitute.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Elsa Chang, our congressional correspondent, is with us all week. Elsa, glad you're here.
Thank you. Today in Your Health, we report on the number one killer of women. Many people are surprised by which disease it is.
We'll find out what it is in a moment. First, we report on vaccine overkill. People are supposed to get boosters for tetanus and diphtheria once every 10 years. Now researchers in Oregon say that's too much. NPR's Ray Allen Bichel reports on the case for once every 30 years.
Tetanus and diphtheria are extremely rare in the U.S.
There's more cases of anthrax every year than there are diphtheria. That's how rare that disease has become, because of vaccinations.
That's Mark Slifka, an immunologist at Oregon Health and Science University. Children get a series of vaccines to protect against the bacteria, and adults are supposed to get a booster shot every 10 years to keep up their immunity. But when Slifka and his colleagues studied about 500 people in Washington and Oregon, they concluded that almost all of them would likely remain protected for at least 30 years.
So you could have one vaccination at the age of 30 and one vaccination at the age of 60. Then you don't have to try and remember how long ago was it when I had my last shot. Instead, you say, oh, well, it's my 30th birthday. I should get my tetanus and diphtheria shot.
Slifka says cutting down on adult vaccination could save about $280 million a year. Dr. Flor Munoz, an infectious disease specialist at Baylor College of Medicine, says the study is compelling.
The rationale, I think, is very sound for looking at this data.
But the big question is, do these results from Oregon apply to the whole country? It would take a bigger study to figure that out. And there's another thing.
One of the assumptions here is that all children receive the vaccines and you have this protection, and we know that's not true. Many children are not vaccinated, and we have actually increasing pockets of unvaccinated young children that might be at risk.
If people don't get the full vaccine series as children and then miss their boosters as adults, that could be bad. After the Soviet Union fell, child vaccination dropped, adults stopped getting boosters, and after years with few cases, thousands of people got diphtheria. Slifka says it was like taking a match to a forest. Rael and Bichelle, NPR News.
Many people think the number one killer of women is cancer. It's not. It's heart disease. And as NPR's Patty Naiman reports, only half of all women know this is their biggest health threat.
Tracy Solomon Clark is outgoing and energetic, a former fundraiser for big companies and big causes. About 6 years ago, at just 44 years old, she had severe shortness of breath. She was dizzy. She went to the doctor and ended up in the hospital. She had no idea her symptoms had anything to do with heart disease.
Not a clue. Heart? That was the furthest thing from my mind. There's no way it would be my heart. I'm young.
But it was her heart. An angiogram showed a blockage and a stent was inserted to open the artery. Even so, doctors did not diagnose heart disease, and Solomon Clark's symptoms persisted.
It felt like a chest cold, and so they would treat me for a chest cold.
Which clearly didn't help. Solomon Clark still felt out of breath and dizzy. Even when she went to the hospital, ER doctors again failed to diagnose heart disease.
And they do an EKG, and they're like, there's nothing wrong, you know. Or she's having anxiety attack.
An anxiety attack for a woman with a clear history of heart problems. At Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, cardiologist Noelle Barry-Merce often sees situations like this. She directs the Barbra Streisand Women's Heart Center, and she recently surveyed about 1,000 women to find out what they knew about their risk for heart disease.
Only about half of women in the United States know that heart disease is the leading healthcare threat for women. A majority of those that didn't know it still thinks it's breast cancer.
About 40,000 women die every year from breast cancer. 10 times as many die from heart disease. Barry-Merce says many of them could be saved. Once women are diagnosed with heart disease, treatments can be highly effective. But lots of women are misdiagnosed, often for years, in part because heart disease looks a lot different in women than it does in men. Most research has focused on men who are prone to blockages in major arteries, which are easy to see on an angiogram. Women, on the other hand, are more likely to have problems with teeny tiny arteries embedded in the heart, which can be difficult to see and aren't likely to fill up with plaque. Barry-Merce.
They don't have enough of a wall to build up plaque. They're that tiny. But what they are is dysfunctional. They can fail to dilate when it's needed, or they actually constrict.
So if a woman suffers a heart attack and there's no obvious blockage, doctors often don't treat them for heart disease. Cardiologist Lakshmi Mehta chaired a committee of the American Heart Association, which just this year wrote its first scientific statement on heart disease and women.
They are less often prescribed the typical medications we give a heart attack patient, such as aspirin, statins, beta blockers.
And even after a heart attack, Mehta says women are less likely than men to be referred to cardiac rehab programs, which dramatically prevent second heart attacks. When Dr. Barry-Merce surveyed women about heart disease, she also surveyed doctors.
Top concerns expressed by the physicians for their female patients, number one was weight management, number two was breast health, and number three was cardiovascular health.
And she says it should be the opposite. Number one, heart health, two, breast health, and three, weight. Dr. Lakshmi Mehta says that with underdiagnosis and undertreatment of women with heart disease, she tries to get across a simple but important message to her female patients.
You need to pay attention to your body. If something seems out of the ordinary, best to seek medical attention, especially if something seems out of the ordinary and is occurring only with exertion or worsening with exertion. I'd rather be wrong and go to the emergency room than die at home, is what I would tell my patients.
Maida says all primary care doctors should assess a woman's risk for heart disease on a routine basis. And if they don't, she says women should take the lead and bring up the subject of heart disease. Patty Namond, NPR News.
Support for your health comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing a range of in-home senior care services with an individualized approach. More at homeinstead.com/NPR. And from Novo Nordisk, whose website actfordiabetes.com is an advocacy tool for patients with diabetes, people at risk, and others affected by diabetes.
This is NPR News.
In 1965, Anne Marshall decided not to marry her boyfriend, a West Point grad who instead went to war.
When I asked him about Vietnam, he said, well, if we don't get married, I'll need to get away, and so I probably will go to Vietnam. It'll be a way to get away.
Memories of the service members we honor this Memorial Day, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune into All Things Considered at 4 o'clock today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It is 8:30, and you are listening to Morning Edition. I'm Maureen McCollum. A national group which protects open space is out with the best of parks, a list of best parks, and for the first time, Madison made the cut. It came in 10th among the 100 most populated cities. Shemaine Mills reports.
The Trust for Public Land picks cities with the best parks based on three criteria: how many residents live within a half mile of a park, how much parkland a city has, and park amenities such as playgrounds, recreational centers, and basketball hoops. Adrian Benepi is director of park development for the Trust. He says one of the reasons Madison did so well in the ranking was its park amenities.
I believe it's tops in the nation in terms of dog parks per capita, and maybe also tops in the nation for basketball hoops. At any rate, you max out on the possible points in three out of the four amenity categories.
Madison lost points for having few recreational and senior centers. The city tied for 10th place with Cincinnati. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Authorities say four people were killed and four others were injured when a fully loaded semi-truck hit a pickup truck and SUV in Walworth County. The Walworth County Sheriff's Office says a preliminary investigation finds that the semi-truck was headed north on Highway K Saturday morning when the pickup truck failed to yield at a stop sign. The semi crashed into the pickup truck's passenger side, and an SUV was also hit. This is WPR.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Door County Wine Fest and Travel Wisconsin. Tickets and more information about Egg Harbor and the June 25th festival is available at DoorCountyWineFest.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Andrea's, proudly serving our Kenosha community since 1911. Visit our cafe for homemade soups, salads, and sandwiches. Go to AndreasGifts.com to find out today's specials.
It will be partly cloudy in far southwest Wisconsin today and sunny elsewhere. Highs will be in the upper 70s in the north to the lower to mid 80s in southern Wisconsin, turning cooler near Lake Michigan. Tonight there is a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the west this evening, then showers and thunderstorms likely after midnight. There's also a chance of showers and slight chance of thunderstorms in the east after midnight. Lows will drop down to the upper 40s to low 50s.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from AT&T, with a network and solutions for helping companies sense and adapt to meet the demands of business. Discover the power of and with AT&T. From Wells Fargo, investing in communities from San Francisco to Tampa with the belief that small measures can have huge meaning for the people they serve. More at wellsfargo.com/together. Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far. And from the National Endowment for the Arts. Art works.
On a Monday morning, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Elsa Chang. If you're flying home today from the long weekend holiday, we hope you have a smooth airport experience. In the past month, long security lines have caused thousands of travelers to miss their flights. The Transportation Security Administration has come under fire for its shortage of screeners. Jay Johnson, director of Homeland Security, which runs the TSA, told Morning Edition last week that he is aggressively addressing the wait times. So to find out what the government has been doing, we called Scott Mayerowitz. He reports on airlines and the TSA for the Associated Press. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Remind us, whatever happened to that $5 TSA fee, the one that we pay each time we fly, the fees known as the 9/11 fee? From what I understand, it's not going to the TSA anymore. So what happened to that money?
So we're still paying that every time we fly. Some of that money is going to the TSA, but a large chunk of it is also being diverted to cover the general federal deficit.
Is there any talk of redirecting those funds back to the TSA?
There has been some talk in Congress about it. There have been a lot of bills in the past few weeks that have surfaced. But if they do give that money back to the TSA, someone has to make a decision to take that money away from someone else, and that's really tough to do in an election year.
Now, if I understand correctly, one of the reasons the TSA cut staff is because they expected lots of people to sign up for the PreCheck program. That's where people are pre-screened and go in a faster line. But not enough people signed up, right? What happened? Why didn't enough people sign up?
So you can screen about 300 people an hour in a PreCheck lane compared to about 150 in a normal security lane. Part of the problem is it costs about $85, and you have to go to an enrollment center. You've got to give up some personal information. You have to be fingerprinted. So what you've had is actually about 9 million people have become a member of PreCheck.
Well below half of what they were targeting.
Well below half of what they were targeting. But because they had this expectation, Congress and the TSA agreed to cut their staff. And about 10% fewer frontline screeners are out at airports today than 3 years ago.
So the government says it's hiring more screeners now. Are they actually hiring enough people, in your opinion?
So they are hiring about 760 more screeners, which was what they were supposed to hire later on in the year. Congress sped that up. The bigger issue is the retention. They're bringing on about 200 new screeners every week right now, but they're also losing 100 screeners each week.
Why is that? Why such a low retention rate?
It's not the best job in the world. The public hates the TSA. Flyers can be really mean people. At the same time, you're staring at a screen watching hundreds of bags come through. If you miss one piece of explosives or one weapon, that's it. You know, you have the terrorist winning. And this is a very high-pressure job. It doesn't pay well, and many of these employees are part-time with no hope of becoming full-time or even advancing on to a supervisory role.
That's Scott Meyerowitz. He reports on airlines and the TSA for the Associated Press.
This week, lawmakers in Illinois face a deadline. By tomorrow, they are supposed to approve a budget. In the time that some states have passed two budgets, Illinois lawmakers have not been able to pass one. Amanda Vinicky of our member station WUIS in Springfield reports on what happens now.
Lawmakers are working throughout the holiday weekend to see if they can accomplish in a few days what they haven't been able to do since last summer, agree on a state budget. Will we see a repeat of this year's ongoing feud between a wealthy, freshly minted Republican governor and Democrats who dominate the legislature? That's left the state without a complete budget for 11 months.
Illinois is really a test case in dysfunction at this point.
That's Emily Miller, who lobbies on behalf of social service providers dependent on state funding. You could rightfully assume that a budget battle is over, well, money. But no, this one is about power and a fundamental clash in philosophy. Democrats, like House Speaker Michael Madigan, accuse Governor Bruce Rauner of holding the budget hostage to unrelated political demands aimed at helping his wealthy friends.
The governor's objections to House Democratic budget priorities are based on his insistence that the General Assembly first pass his personal agenda, which is targeted at diminishing the wages and the standard of living of the middle class and other struggling families.
Rauner's a former private equity investor who's now investing tens of millions of dollars in Republican campaigns, including his own. He became Illinois' first GOP governor in a dozen years last January. Rauner's agenda calls for stripping unions of collective bargaining rights, reducing the compensation available to injured workers, and term limits for legislators. The governor says he'll agree to a tax hike.
Nobody thinks that a tax hike alone
just a tax hike to balance a budget is the right thing to do. They don't want hardworking families here, it's hardworking small business owners. They don't want their money to go into a broken system that they can't trust will actually use their money wisely and balance the budgets in the future.
Meanwhile, the deficit continues to build. Illinois' $100 billion in long-term pension debt stands unabated. Some of the state's public universities are laying off faculty and closing programs. Applications are down as wary students apply out of state, and legislators' paychecks are delayed because there isn't money to pay them on time. Likewise for insurance companies, electric utilities, and other vendors. That's led dozens of fed-up social service agencies, including an early childhood nonprofit run by Governor Rauner's own wife, to sue the state. Some weren't able to wait and shut down. While the political fight drags on, Emily Miller with Voices for Illinois Children says it takes a very real human toll.
For some people, this is a matter of life and death. There are, for example, suicide hotlines where if you call, you're told that there's a six-month waiting list to speak to somebody. If you are facing mental challenges that significant, being told that you need to wait 6 months to speak to somebody is not helpful, and you're likely not going to get the help you need in time.
If lawmakers don't reach a bipartisan compromise by tomorrow, there's a big chance Illinois' stalemate will drag on as they turn their political focus elsewhere. The effort to try to retain their seats in November's election. For NPR News, I'm Amanda Vinicky in Springfield, Illinois.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 8:41, and you are listening to Morning Edition on this Memorial Day here on Wisconsin Public Radio. News is coming up next, and in 10 minutes on Marketplace Morning Report, why animal hospice care that focuses on the quality instead of the extension of life for old and ailing pets could save homeowners both money and emotional grief. That plus all the morning's business news in 10 minutes.
Supporting Wisconsin Public Radio is voluntary. It's a choice, and that's why we're so grateful to our members. You don't have to donate, but you do. Because of you, there are 24 hours a day of inspiring, informative programs on the radio, every day. Thank you so much for your support.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. At least six people have died in Texas because of heavy rains and flooding from Austin to San Antonio. Authorities say they made numerous water rescues. Some areas received 10 inches of rainfall in less than 24 hours. There's no word yet on a possible motive after a gunman walked into an auto detailing shop in Texas and began shooting. It happened yesterday in Houston. A customer was killed. Several others were wounded, including two constable deputies who were responding to the scene. A SWAT team officer shot and killed the suspect. Ray Hunt is president of the Houston Police Officers Union.
You get a shooting call and you get to the location, you're not sure who the good guys are, who the bad guys are. You have to quickly evaluate what's going on and make the appropriate calls. And I believe in this case, all the uniformed officers here and the SWAT team did just that.
Game 7 of the NBA's Western Conference Finals is tonight. NPR's Tom Goldman says the Golden State Warriors have battled back in this series to force a deciding game against the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Golden State won the championship last year and a record 73 regular season games this year. But the Warriors appear to have met their match and more after Oklahoma City roared to a 3-1 series lead and dominated Golden State in the process. But after two straight season-saving wins, Golden State has a chance to clinch the series tonight on its home court.
The winner plays Cleveland in the finals. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. Cheese that's being held in storage is at a record high. According to the USDA, refrigerated warehouses are holding the most cheese since 1917. Some reports have referred to this as a cheese crisis or a glut, but demand for Wisconsin cheeses means producers here are not worried. That's especially true for specialty cheese like Gouda and feta. Organic Valley cheese brand manager Andrew Westrich says it's the same for organic cheese.
it's a function of more and more consumers are continuing to trade up to organics, and organics are becoming more and more of an influence in the mainstream grocery channel and have gotten out of the natural foods and co-op sphere of things.
Westrich says they're trying to keep up with demand by getting more farmers to transfer their farms to organic, which can take a few years. Police in Appleton say a robbery suspect shot an officer and another man during a struggle before killing himself. Police Chief Todd Thomas said during a news conference that the suspect stole cigarettes from two gas stations Friday night and Saturday morning. An officer spotted the suspect and a fight ensued. Two men driving by stopped to help the officer. The suspect took the officer's gun away, shot her in the hip, shot one of the men in the chest, and then shot himself in the head. The chief said the officer and the man's injuries were not life-threatening. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Living Essentials, maker of 5-Hour Energy Shots, available in Cherry Extra Strength flavor with the red, white, and blue bottle, and supporting Special Operations Warrior Foundation. Learn more at 5hourenergy.com. From Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit organization celebrating 40 years of educational travel adventures for adults, offering departures to Cuba. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Starting a company used to be time-consuming and expensive. Now, in many developed countries, it can be done with the click of a mouse. But in its race to be business-friendly, Great Britain is finding it has unintentionally created opportunities for corruption. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from a particular address in London.
This is Harley Street, one of the most expensive in all of London. Georgian row houses, brass plates, exclusive medical clinics. Number 29 was once the home of a wealthy surgeon. Now, it's the headquarters of more than 2,000 companies. Here's investigative journalist Oliver Below.
If you say, my business is based on Harley Street, it's like, oh, okay, he's got to be doing all right. But you don't have an office on Harley Street, obviously. All you're doing is paying, you know, 200 quid a year, and you get to say you do. The whole thing is, it's a front.
A front office for companies around the world that want a prestigious address in London, but aren't actually here. The only company physically at 29 Harley Street is Formations House. They'll help you set up shop in London or form an offshore company in a tax haven. That's all perfectly legal. And up until now, you didn't even have to say who the owners are.
You know, you're supposed to have a... As a director, you have to have a real person, not just another company. You have to have an actual living, breathing person as a guard against fraud. But they've essentially automated this whole system. I registered my own company. I called it Crooked Crook Crook because I got a silly sense of humor, and it took me 9 minutes. There you go.
More than 500,000 companies are created in the UK each year. Most go through agencies like this, and most are legitimate. But Google 29 Harley Street and warnings pop up about scams. It was the mailing address for a convicted multi-million dollar swindler in Las Vegas and an offshore company linked to the ornate palace of Viktor Yanukovych, the former president of Ukraine. One of the directors of Formations House was charged in a fraud case, but he died last year before the trial. Charlotte Power is the company's UK manager. She says it's unfair to blame Formations agents for their clients' actions.
If I'm honest, I think that they're putting the blame on Formation agents for people overseas being able to buy properties here and register them. We just provide a platform to incorporate companies.
They can't police what those companies do after that, she says. But British Prime Minister David Cameron can.
If you don't know who owns what, you can't stop people stealing from poor countries and hiding that stolen wealth in rich ones.
So next month, the UK will launch a public register of true company ownership. That will mean a lot more due diligence.
Yeah, my name's Richard Langridge and I'm the compliance officer here, making sure any dishonest clients being reported to the National Crime Agency.
Langridge works for Servcorp, another company that offers virtual offices for clients around the world. He has to vet them if they want to do business in the UK.
We can look at the latest annual return, for instance, you know, who owns the shares in the company. Anyone who's a beneficial owner, we need to know who they are.
Servcorp has 40,000 clients. Langridge is the company's only compliance officer for the UK. The British government soon may be similarly stretched, trying to vet millions of companies. By streamlining business regulation, the UK has climbed to number 6 on the World Bank's Ease of Doing Business Index. The government is proud of that. Now it has to decide whether it's willing to make a similar effort to halt the corruption that came with it. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Tonight on All Things Considered, Lauren has a story of how illicit wealth has found its way into London's property market and what that does to house prices. This is NPR News.
It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, and stay with us. The music starts in 15 minutes. Today's highlights include a couple of pieces in honor of Memorial Day, plus the Mother Goose Suite by Ravel and a violin sonata by Mozart. Join Norman Gilliland for Morning Classics right after the 9 o'clock news, and stay with us. The Marketplace Morning Report is next here on WPR.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies in the circle of life. They believe that every detail counts and every memory matters. Piasecki Althaus is located in Kenosha on 39th Avenue, serving the community since 1931.
Is the culminating event and celebrates award recipients in each category. WPR is pleased to support young musical theater talent. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
It will be partly cloudy in far southwest Wisconsin today and sunny elsewhere across the state. Highs will be in the upper 70s in the north to the lower to mid 80s in southern Wisconsin, turning cooler near Lake Michigan. Tonight, a chance of showers and thunderstorms.
Support for WPR comes from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. From county to county, Badgers and Wisconsin work together for a stronger state that broadens the meaning of possible. More is at boundlesstogether.org.
WGTD is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. A cultural asset and a community resource, WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College with additional financial support from the Wisconsin Public Radio Association and local underwriters whose customers value public radio.
New food safety rules, plus a business story about hospice for pets.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, small business protection for more than vehicles with specialized coverages to protect against financial loss. More at progressivecommercial.com.
From Marketplace in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. In just 1 week, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew and Federal Reserve Vice Chair Stanley Fischer will meet their counterparts in Beijing for an annual catch-up for representatives of the two biggest economies. It is the worst-kept secret in the financial world that U.S. interest rates are set to go up, if not next month, and very soon after, and that can diminish the value of non-U.S. currencies, like, of course, China's yuan. The meeting will come as China makes its way along a bumpy path of reforms that are supposed to give markets more say in its domestic economy and the government less say. And that means slower, but it is hoped, more sustainable growth. Whether China really becomes a market-based economy also has important implications for global trade. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
First off, is China a market economy?
I think it would certainly be a stretch to call China a market economy at this stage.
Ishwar Prasad is a professor at Cornell University and former China head at the IMF. But weirdly, whether China is a market economy is not the question. It's whether to give them that label. See, 15 years ago, China joined the World Trade Organization. And part of that agreement was that the country would be labeled a non-market economy for 15 years. Time's up. China thinks it should get its new label. Paul Rosenthal is a partner with the law firm Kelly Dry and Warren. He represents U.S. manufacturers who really worry about this label change.
It's a real concern about the Chinese being able to unfairly trade in the United States without adequate remedies being applied.
That's the reason the label matters. The change would make it much harder to slap Chinese products with high tariffs if the government finds they're being sold too cheaply, below market, in a way that hurts U.S. producers. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
U.S. financial markets are closed for Memorial Day here. The Dow went into the holiday weekend up 2.6% for the year so far. The S&P 500 year-to-date is about the same. The NASDAQ composite here in 2016 is down 1.5%. London is also closed today for a bank holiday Monday there. The DAX in Germany is up about 0.3%. Today's barbecue, if it's veggie patties or a big old portobello mushroom, then perhaps you can ignore the next item. There are new labeling requirements from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for packages of steak. Producers now have to warn you if your meat has been mechanically tenderized. Cheaper cuts essentially pummeled so they don't seem like shoe leather. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
Meat producers know people like their meat tender, and so sometimes they tenderize it for you. Randy Phoebus at Kansas State University has studied the process for decades.
A big portion of the steaks that you buy at, you know, your steakhouses and food service, those are tenderized.
Producers use tiny needles or blades to pierce, say, a steak or a roast. But that process can introduce bacteria into the center of the meat. Here's USDA's Kathy Cochran.
Previously, if you went to the store and you bought a steak, you may not know that the product was mechanically tenderized. You can't tell by looking at the surface of the product.
But now you can tell by looking at the label. But that small change can have a hefty price tag. Mark Dopp is with the North American Meat Institute.
Changing labels is not costless, so it doesn't affect every company. But for those companies that it affects, we're talking several $1 million.
And those costs could end up being passed on to the consumer. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Epson, offering cartridge-free printing with EcoTank, their refillable ink tank printer. EcoTank comes with up to 2 years of ink for printing up to 8,000 pages. And by Iowa, offering a business climate with educated professionals and workers in manufacturing, biosciences, and financial services. IowaEconomicDevelopment.com.
Americans spend about $60 billion a year on our pets. This includes spending on end-of-life for animal companions. From WHYY in Philadelphia, Todd Bookman is the reporter's name. He reports on the rise of palliative care for critters and animal hospice.
Paul Rosin has seen lots of dogs come and go during his 79 years. Suki, you get the sense, wouldn't make his Hall of Fame.
Among the dogs I've had, I would say she's less than average in intelligence.
Ah, but what she lacks in brains, the Shaggy White Terrier makes up for in loyalty.
She's been a good companion, and she's a surprisingly young dog. I mean, if you look at her, you wouldn't think she was 15 years old. She's pretty active.
Suki is starting to show her 15 years, though. She's got a heart murmur, arthritis, and she started leaving unwanted puddles around the house. That's prompted a visit from veterinarian Tam Menjean.
Well, we'll go ahead and do her checkup.
Okay. And
Menjean is one of a fast-growing number of vets who specialize in end-of-life and palliative care. She avoids aggressive treatments, focusing instead on managing symptoms and reducing pain or anxiety.
Maybe they're sniffing the smells on the porch and watching the birds instead of chasing them through the woods. They're still happy, so why not let them have that joy?
But the pet hospice concept is also for the owners. It helps them avoid hard decisions about expensive treatments and, when the time comes, opt for in-home euthanasia. Danny McVitie is co-founder of Lap of Love, a national franchise of hospice providers.
The greatest gift that we give the pet is the release from pain and suffering. And the greatest gift that we can give the family is the release of guilt and the privacy to grieve.
Lap of Love operates a network of 80 doctors who did more than 15,000 home visits last year. Their clients do pay a premium. In-home euthanasia runs about $250. That's more than most clinics charge. Suki, though, isn't there yet. The vet suggests Paul Rosin start her on a joint supplement for the arthritis. He's determined to enjoy the time they have left.
I give her more treats than I used to. She likes the dried chicken. I used to say, I'll give her one or two a day. You know, I'm a spoiler, but now I give her a lot because what the hell? That's one of the things she really loves.
You only live once, right? In Philadelphia, I'm Todd Bookman for Marketplace.
And the top news in the Silicon Valley in the past few days was the revelation that billionaire investor Peter Thiel was secretly bankrolling Hulk Hogan's successful invasion of privacy lawsuit. That suit led to a $140 million judgment against Gawker Media, which had separately run headlines about Thiel's personal life, a subject which Thiel felt was nobody else's business. But there's word that another Silicon Valley billionaire might help Gawker with its appeal, if not with money, then in spirit. The Associated Press is reporting that First Look Media is trying to get other news organizations to join it in filing briefs in support of Gawker's appeal. First Look is funded by Pierre Omidyar, one of the eBay founders. Gawker may have to put up $50 million bond just to get the appeal going, and First Look argues that is an issue of freedom of the press. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. from APM, American Public Media.
And yet to come this morning, well, there will be more news, of course, at one past the hours, and plenty of music, too, in between those reports from NPR here on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from the UW Health Breast Center, providing second opinions for Wisconsin women and men diagnosed with breast cancer. In healthcare, experience matters. More at uwhealth.org/second opinion.
WGTD is on your smartphone. For local news and the rest of the mobile version of our website, log on to WGTD.org. For live audio streams of WGTD, 24/7 Jazz HD2, and Sports Web, visit the App Store and download the free WGTD app.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.